My name is Kathleen Mullen, and this is the session on poetry and prayer. And the title of today's session is Psalms and Prayers for Today. Because this session is called Poetry and Prayer, I always like to start with a prayer. Sometimes we say one out loud, and sometimes we say one quietly, and since I feel in rather more quiet a mood today, I think I'll ask that you join me in a quiet prayer. Perhaps what we could focus our thinking on, our presence on, is the idea of prayers for today. What is it about today that needs praying for? And that today can mean anything. Today in our own lives, today in the life of the world, today in the lives of people we don't have any idea who they are, what they might need from us. So with ever understanding that each of us brings to the Word today, let's take a minute to say a prayer for today. Okay, and the other thing I like to do, and especially since this morning we have so many new folks who are stopping in for the first time, I think that the essential act that the poet performs for the world is to name the things that he or she sees. A lot of times we wander through the world and we don't really see the things that are around us, but if somebody says to us, oh, that's a such and so, well, somehow that stands out for us the next time we wander around. One of the things I remember in my life was, a couple things. I like flowers, and I know the names of some of them, and I don't know the names of other ones. And a friend taught me the name of the flower columbine. And so every time I see that flower, it stands out for me in some way. And I say columbine, and then I think gratefully of the person who taught me the name of that flower. And I think that's basically what goes on in the poet's life as well. She tries to name as precisely, as distinctly, and as vividly as possible the things which can mean events, situations, people, anything in the world. And by that, to make those things, two things for us, words that I use when I teach my freshman composition class, tries to make those things unmistakable. I'm not going to be able to spell today. That's unmistakable. E-A-B-L-E, I think, but I'm not sure about that one. That the poet tries to make the things in our world unmistakable for us, that we couldn't think that a columbine was a pansy. It's too impossible. It's impossible to mix those two things up. And the other thing that the poet does for us is try to make those things unforgettable. I will never forget columbine. Why? Because it was a joy to know the name of the thing in the first place, and it's a pleasure to remember having learned the thing. So the poet's work is to make the world unmistakable, the things of the world, not the world, the things that the world is composed of, unmistakable and unforgettable for us. Now, I've been trying in my mind to make continued connections between poetry and the theme at Holden for the summer, the theme of gentle justice. When I came here, I felt kind of out of place because everybody else was so active and wanted to change the world and things like that. People were wandering around reading books like To Change the World. I was wandering around reading books like The Earth Speaks, and I'm saying, something is wrong here. I don't know. I don't quite exactly know what the connections are here. But just as I'm using this pair of words, I'm thinking how the poet's work is necessary for gentle justice in the world, because the poet can make the oppressions of the world unforgettable for us. It's only in language that most of us can experience the oppressions in El Salvador, Guatemala, in the third world nations. Only through the words of those who have seen, for whom those things have been unmistakable and unforgettable in their own lives. And so without poets in the world, we would not understand, we would not know some of the things that call out for justice. And without the poet, I think, to teach us compassion, we certainly wouldn't have any understanding of what gentle justice is in the world. So that's my connection, which I just made right now for today, of how poetry and a gentle justice work together in the world. My quotation that I've chosen, oh, I'm sorry, I get back to naming. I do get digressed here. It's another thing that poets do. They get off the track. Then you have to say, what did you start to say? And then they say, oh. And then they say, would you please tell us who you are? Tell us what your names are. In this new group, this gathered group that we have, some new and some old together for.
Ida Stasberg.
And you are where you want to be right
Los
now.
From Los Angeles.
Okay. Ida from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Even the old folks.
Okay. It's old folks. I'm Tucky, and I'm from Thousand Oaks near Los Angeles.
Oh. Debbie Kilpatrick from Seattle.
Debbie from Seattle.
Mac Smith from Seattle.
Mac? Mac, that's my dog's name. You make me miss him. he's really a sweetie, so I'm sure you are too, Mac.
She tells you to sit up.
No, it's more likely I'll go scratch it behind your ears, and then where will we be? Yes.
Dorothy Kaufman from Seattle.
Dorothy?
Rich Mathis, Seattle.
Rich from Seattle. Lots of, how do you say, Seattleians? Seattleans?
Seattleites.
Seattleites.
Mm-hmm. Marion Johnson, and I'm from Seattle.
Ah, Marion, did you say? Uh-huh. Marion.
Jenny Barker, I'm from Seattle.
Well, hi.
Surrounded by a...
Bob Lundgren from Portland, Oregon.
We've got a Portlander here. Yeah.
Our David Roderick from Thousand Oaks.
Thousand Oaks, right. And?
John Holmstead, Astoria, Oregon.
Astoria, Oregon. Well, you haven't come with anybody, huh? You're just all here by yourself.
My wife and I.
And this person who comes in the back door.
Bill Strello from Chicago.
Bill Strello from Chicago. Okay, well, welcome to the session this morning. In a sense, we've done everything we need to do, so I might as well just say go home. We've prayed. We've named things. We've tried to connect the gentle justice theme. We really have connected the gentle justice theme and the poetry theme. So what I have for you today is poems and psalms for today. And my quotation that I'm choosing this morning is one that I learned when I was a sophomore, or freshman, I guess, in high school. Does anybody recognize where that comes from? Emily and the stage manager? I know I have a real squinchy handwriting.
No,
I will read it to you. The dialogue between Emily and the stage manager comes from Thornton Wilder's play Our Town. Our Town, if you know the play, takes the kind of typical life of typical families in Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, and shows how things people come to life, and they live, and they love, and they die. And the interesting thing in Wilder is that he has the boldness to take us beyond death and to show us some things from the perspective of the dead who are actually taking part in the play and are on the stage. The point at which this piece of dialogue comes is after Emily has died. We've watched Emily grow up from a little girl who says, "Mama, am I pretty?" and falls in love with her sweetheart, marries, has a child, and then dies early in her life. And she comes, newly dead, into the place of the dead on the stage. And the stage manager is a kind of a ubiquitous character. He shepherds everybody through what they have to get through in life and in the play. And it is he who has brought Emily to the world of the dead. And she's shocked. Now, this is a new world for her entirely. And the dead are not active people in this play. They're very passive. They're sitting on the stage under and the burial party who has just brought Emily are under umbrellas, and they are going away. And Emily badly needs some comfort. And she says to the stage manager, "Does anyone ever really realize life while they're living it?" And the stage manager, in his kind of laconic New England drawl, says, "Nope. Saints and poets, maybe. They do some." So I would invite you to be saints and poets. And the way to do that, of course, is to really realize life while you are living it. And I think that the example of some of the writings that I've brought today will help us to see how poets realize life while they are living it. This is the third in the second series of sessions that I'm giving on this topic. And the first two have been called God and the Poet. And what we've been mainly looking at there is the varieties of ways that poets speak to God and the varieties of aspects of God that that way of speaking implies. And I'd like to continue that to some extent, and I've got four ones that I'd like for us to look at today. This first one is from this book, Prayers from the Ark, which is translated from the French by Rumer Gauden and is written by Carmen Bernus de Gastold. And it's in the library. There are two copies in the library. So if you like these ones, perhaps you'd like to take a look and see what more we have. Then the second ones I'd like to look at is a really kind of a strange combination. Anne Sexton's poems, and then a translation or an update of Psalm 90 by a poet named Sebastian Moore. And then just in case we don't have enough to talk about, here's another one. One that I'm very interested in, and one that I think can show us a model for some kind of form of poetry that we ourselves might try. This is called A Cycle of Holocaust Songs by Monica Kelwick. So I think there's enough for everybody to go around for today, but I have forgotten to keep one of the second one for myself, one of the Anne Sexton ones, the one that begins small wire.
Okay.
Okay. Now, everybody should have three sets of ones. One. And just kind of leave them around or bring them up after when you're finished. And if there's not enough for everybody, you can look on with another. Okay, thanks. The one I want to look at first is the stuff from the Prayers from the Ark. But before that, I have a hidden agenda today, and let me tell you what it is. I have volunteered to do matins tomorrow morning, and what I'd like to do is have some pieces of writing from folks who may have written something while you have been here. I don't know how many of you are writers or would be writers, or would simply like to share some of the thoughts that you've tried to put into words with the community as part of matins for tomorrow. So part of my hidden agenda is that there are several different forms of writing that we'll be looking at today. And these forms might give you some impetus, some suggestions for how you might put your own thoughts into words that you might want to share with us for tomorrow morning. So the first one, I think, is in many ways the easiest one. One of the techniques that poets use to do poems is personification. Do you remember what that is from back in sophomore in high school? What's a personification?
Giving life to the words, giving life to something.
To something what? Giving life to what?
Inanimate object.
Okay. For instance, I might personify what this thing, this marker, might feel like having gone through 2 weeks of use at Holden. I might write in the person of. I might endow this thing with characteristics that it does not usually have, and personify some things that in that way. That's what de Gastold has done in this poem, in this section of things called Prayers from the Ark. You might expect what he's done. He's taken the beasts that have been part of the Ark experience, and he has given words to them. And the two that I've chosen for you are the Prayer of the Little Bird and the Prayer of the Goat. Would anyone like to read the Prayer of the Little Bird for us? It's an easy one. Good, thank you. John is going to read that. John from Oregon.
Astoria, right.
Astoria, Oregon. Okay.
Dear God, I don't know how to pray by myself very well, but will you please protect my little nest from wind and rain? Put a great deal of dew on the flowers, many seeds in my way. Make your blue very high, your black branches listen. Let your light, kind light, stay light, late in the sky, and set my heart brimming with such music that I must sing, sing, sing. Please, Lord.
Okay. Now we've had a masculine little bird. Could we have a feminine little bird to read these words for us?
All right. Mm-hmm. Dear God, I don't know how to pray by myself very well, but will you please protect my little nest from wind and rain? Put a great deal of dew on the flowers, many seeds in my way. Make your blue very high, your branches listen. Let your kind light stay late in the sky and set my heart brimming with such music that I must sing, sing, sing. Please, Lord.
Okay, thank you. Very lovely voices in which the prayer of the little bird has been read. What draws you in this poem? What kind of connections do you feel, do you sense with this poem?
Prayer by myself. That's difficult for many people.
Okay, prayer by yourself. Okay, this bird is not singing in a bunch of birds. Not singing, in, definitely not singing out of the LBW at Vespers. This bird is praying in solitude, okay? And something that's very difficult, John says, for himself. For many of us, I would suspect. What else? What else interests you, attracts your attention about it? You know, anything you say is right. So there's no question about that. Anything that makes you feel like a kindred spirit with this bird, or doesn't make you feel like a kindred spirit?
Praise for his home.
All right, a praise for his home. Okay, where in the poem is that?
Protect my little nest from
wind and rain. Okay, protect my little nest from wind and rain. Will you please protect my little nest from wind and rain? Okay, something that is very close to him. The bird prays to God for that. What else?
For food and daily needs.
For food and daily needs. Now, how about this little bird? He says, put a great deal of dew on the flowers, many seeds in my way. What about that bird?
He doesn't want just little.
He doesn't want just enough to... this is not give us this day my daily bread. This is, give me a bunch, please.
Abundance.
God is an abundant God for this little bird. God is a protective God for this little bird. Put a great deal, an abundance of the things which sustain life in my way. Okay? What else?
Now, he wants to have his heart set brimming, with joy, essentially.
Okay, all right. What's going to do that? What does he connect his heart's brimming with?
The light, the blue sky.
Make your blue very high. Why does the bird want the blue to be very high?
So we can
Okay. Was anybody with us earlier when we talked about Emily Dickinson in her the line of her poem? Molten blue is what she calls the sky. I think the bird might, feel something like that. Make your blue very high. Okay. And now here's one that, here's a new word. I don't know, I think the bird knows this word and many of us don't know this word. What is the word that the bird knows?
Listen.
Listen. And what does listen mean?
Last taken.
Okay, good, kind of good. Oh, I like the way you've done that. You've defined the word by a gesture. Okay, and that's in some sense how the bird would understand it as well. Make the boughs elastic. Make them bendable. Make them springy. Okay, listen. Okay, so that you don't kind of clunk down on it, but then it goes with you as well. Make your branches listen, and let your kind light stay late in the sky. And all of these things, almost as a cumulative effect of all of these things, what will happen with the bird? Set my heart. Let's say it all together. And set my heart brimming with such music that I must sing, sing, sing. All right, I like this little bird. Tell me the things that we know about God from hearing the song of the little bird.
He's a protector.
Okay, God is a protector.
He provides.
He provides in abundance, which the bird hopes for. What else?
Creator.
He is a creator. Mm-hmm.
He listens even to the little ones.
He listens even to the little ones. This little bird, this is no bald eagle or golden eagle or anything. This is just the prayer of the little bird, okay? The little bird has enough courage, enough confidence that he too can speak to the Lord. What else is the Lord?
He brings joy. Brings joy, set my heart brimming.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? He brings joy, and what is the little bird's response here?
Give back and sing.
Okay. What God has done is set the bird's heart brimming with such joy that I must sing. Okay. You get a sense of how intense that feeling of return, of reciprocity must be with the repetition of the word sing three times. Poet could have used three different words, that I may carol, warble, sing, but he didn't. He just said sing. So we have a sense that God's love, God's abundance, God's protection, God's availability, God's care for us asks for a return from us as well. I mean, how would God feel if the bird didn't sing?
Yeah.
I don't know. Please, Lord. Now, we've got quite another different animal in the prayer of the goat. By the way, if you're looking for forms in which to cast your words, you might consider personification. What does your little bird say to God? What words would you put in the mouth of the birds which you have seen and heard around here? I noticed in the Hike House the other day that there was a list of about 58, I believe there were, different birds that a bird-watching person who was here had seen and holden. So, I don't know, would the red, with the yellow-crested chaffinch sing the same song as the... Okay, so think about it. Let those birds sing in your ears and see what words you hear those birds saying to you or to the Lord or to Holden or to anybody. Prayer of the goat. Anybody want to try a goat? Yes. Yeah.
Say it on a bird. You can only ask for himself. You did not ask for other birds as well. It's very narrow.
And narrow-minded bird.
An introverted bird.
This is not a bird who is concerned for the community. No, this is true.
I would say that he has to take care of himself before he can take care of others.
He's nurturing his own needs.
And once he can experience that and be fed and nurtured in himself, then he is of use and of benefit to those around him and can take care of
himself. But isn't that typical of us as people? Mm-hmm. We pray for our home, for our surroundings, and then we pray for the outside, for the food and all that.
Good thoughts. Maybe we need to teach the little bird some different words. And if you think the little bird's only praying for himself, what about the, where do you see the prayer of the goat? Anybody want to be a goat? Anybody? There was a couple of people who came in late. Are there extra copies of any of this around? If there are, here are some. Okay, anybody want to be the goat? Give it a try.
That's my sign.
Your sign is the goat, okay.
Lord, let me live as I will. I need a little wild freedom, a little giddiness of heart, the strange taste of unknown flowers. For whom else are your mountains, your snow wind, these springs? The sheep do not understand. They graze and graze, all of them, and always in the same direction. And then eternally they chew and cud of their insipid routine. But I love to bound to the heart of all your marvels, leap your chasms, and my mouth stuffed with intoxicating grasses, quiver with an adventurous delight on the summit of the world.
It's the one, it's when I was choosing these from a book in a different library, it's the one that the book fell open to. look, you see, here we go. And if I'm kidding, here is the prayer of the goat. This must be one that calls out to the folks who come to Holden as well as the Tulane Library. Okay. How about the prayer of the goat? Lord, let me live as I will. I need a little wild freedom. A little giddiness of heart, a strange taste of unknown flowers. For whom else are your mountains, your snow wind, these springs, the sheep do not understand. They graze and graze all of them and always in the same direction, and then eternally chew the cud of their insipid routine. But I love to bound to the heart of all your marvels, leap your chasms, and my mouth stuffed with intoxicating grasses quiver with an adventurer's delight on the summit of the world. Oh, wow, what a goat, what a goat. Mountain goat.
There's great contrast in that.
Between that one and the little bird. Right. Hey, anybody want to talk about this goat? Is this a prayer?
It's a celebration of life, which would be considered a prayer.
Okay. Celebration. Just as I said, the goat is a whole lot more selfish than the bird, huh? Because the bird only asks for himself, but this goat has no good words to say for the sheep at all. As a matter of fact, half of the stuff that he's talking about is how yucky the sheep and their lives are.
How much better he is.
How much better he is.
They don't really appreciate.
Well, what is it that he dislikes about the sheep so much?
They're so mundane.
Their sameness.
Mundane.
They're mundane.
Yeah, right. Their lack of awareness of what life could be.
Okay, they graze and then they chew it all up over again. Okay, they don't know what life could be. And they always go in the same direction. They always do the same thing over and over again. Have you ever felt like that about some folks? Have you ever? You felt like a sheep, okay? I wonder whether there's the prayer of the sheep in here. You know, I didn't even check that. We ought to give the sheep, no sheep. Donkey, bee, monkey, butterfly, giraffe, owl, cricket, cat, blower, mouse, goat, elephant, but no sheep. Somebody ought to take it upon herself to be a sheep and make the prayer of the sheep that should go in here. Okay, but it's a celebration of life. I don't know, is it a prayer? What kind of, let me back off for a minute. What kind of God is this one that to whom the goat prays? What face of the Lord does the goat know?
Joyful
and fun-loving, a bounding God, a dancing, leaping God.
It could be the other way, though. Let me live as I will. In other words, don't put any strains on me. So you can look at the... the cult of the individual, and looking down, and of course, that's what we say in America today, that we're a group of individuals. We want to do our thing, mm-hmm. And many times, regardless of what we want to do, other people might get hurt from it, but he's bounding and doing his thing.
He's going to do it. I mean, there does seem a little bit of selfishness in this goat. He starts off by saying, frankly, what he wants, let me live as I will.
He has an appreciation of the beauty around him because he's saying, I love to bow to the heart of all your marvels. Mm-hmm. So he isn't without some ascetic appreciations.
But he's in contrast to the sheep, though, that blindly follow and go along and do the same thing day after day. He's in contrast to the goat who's giddy and enjoying the life. There's a real contrast between those.
Okay, and if we talk about the individualist, we would have to say that the sheep are definitely not part of the individualistic God.
Prayer of a teenager.
Prayer of a teenager, yeah.
But I take exception to that.
That's your prayer as well.
I grew up in those mountains. I'm going to chew you on the flower.
I tried flowers next
time. But even though it's individualistic, he's praying to God and he... I don't know what I'm thinking, but acknowledging God's role in creation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That way too. It isn't just totally selfish individualism in a sense. It's being able to appreciate what's out there.
Sure, and if God made man in his image and likeness, male and female, he created them. In a sense, we've got the goat arrogating that same thing to him. I mean, the goat knows God must understand. Because God made the goat, and this is the way the goat is, so the goat God must be something like that as well. So there's that assumption of likeness in this. And I don't know, maybe your God is the God of the little bird, the protector and the abundant provider. But maybe God is the God of the goat as well. I think the great diversity and the great variety of God is the thing that these poems celebrate in very down-to-earth and very simple little ways. And this is not stuff that's going to last 300 years and be the hallmark of the 1960s in poetry.
Right.
But it is something that can bring us to some different perceptions some different realizations, and I think some different ways of thinking about things. Maybe make it clearer for us where we identify. Help us to understand what our instinctive and joyful responses to God are better in that way.
Don't you think at times we have the prayer of the bird and other times the prayer of the goat?
Yeah, and I'm sure we have the prayer of the monkey and the prayer of the foal, and the prayer of the butterfly. Oh, the prayer of the butterfly. Lord, where was I? Oh yes, this flower, this sun, thank you. Your world is beautiful. The scent of roses, where was I? A drop of dew rose to sparkle in a lily's heart. I have to go. Where? I don't know. The wind has painted fancies on my wings. Fancies? Where was I? Oh, yes. Lord, I had something to tell you.
Oh,
prayer of the butterfly. The butterfly is scatterbrained. I mean, never quite gets around to saying what's necessary to there. Okay, let's turn a little bit and see something that's rather more different and difficult, I think. And not quite so light and happy. But again, a different way of seeing and a different way of perceiving who God is to the contemporary poet. I'd like for you to look at Anne Sexton's poem, The Rowing Endeth. And that's it's about the third page of the group that begins with Small Wire. Anybody have that? Do you want to look? Is there an extra one? If you would look, if you would share, please. This is the final poem. The other ones on this page are pieces of poems also from the end of that book. But Anne Sexton is a contemporary writer, and the name of the volume that this one comes from is The Awful Rowing Toward God. And this, The Rowing Endeth, is the final poem in the volume. And Sexton details in this book not a joyful swooping toward God, not the prayer of the simplest of God's creatures, but the prayer of a burdened, insecure, mentally unstable, confused woman of her time. She is a woman with her own experience in mental hospitals, who has had the courage, I think, to allow into her poetry the experiences of disorientation and divorcement from the world around her, and yet still help us to see that people of all kinds are moving toward God in their own ways. The awful rowing toward God. Anybody have a rowboat? Okay. You know what that feels like. Yeah. And this is a boat over definitely choppy seas. And there are many things in Sexton's life which have made her seas very choppy. But her destination is always toward God. Many times she doesn't know who God is, or is not too sure she's going to recognize him when she does find him. She hears conflicting voices in the world around her, saying, no, this is not God, yes, this is God, etc. But in the final poem of the book, she tells us that at least for this time, and in this way, the rowing endeth. And she presents to us an image of God, which I dare say most of us have not experienced. I know I've never had it when I read this poem. But I think it's a very rich image of God. And I hope that we can learn something about both poetry and the prayer of a contemporary sensibility in reading it. The rowing endeth. I'm mooring my rowboat at the dock of an island called God. This dock is made in the shape of a fish, and there are many boats moored at many different docks. It's okay, I say to myself, with blisters that broke and healed and broke and healed, saving themselves over and over, and salt sticking to my face and arms like a glue skin pocked with grains of tapioca. I empty myself from my wooden boat and onto the flesh of the island. On with it, he says, and thus we squat on the rocks by the sea and play, can it be true, a game of poker. He calls me. I win because I hold a royal straight flush. He wins because he holds five aces. A wild card had been announced, but I had not heard it, being in such a state of awe when he took out the cards and dealt. As he plunks down his five aces, and I sit grinning at my royal flush, he starts to laugh, the laughter rolling like a hoop out of his mouth and into mine, and such laughter that he doubles over me, laughing a rejoice chorus at our two triumphs. Then I laugh, the fishy dock laughs, the sea laughs, the island laughs, the absurd laughs. Dearest dealer, I, with my royal straight flush, love you so for your wild card, that untamable, eternal, gut-driven ha-ha, and lucky love. You like that?
Strong.
You like that? Strong. Okay, it's not like the prayer of the butterfly by any means. Okay, it's not like, who is it like? More the bird, the butterfly, or the goat?
Like
it's more like the goat, because there's this, more of a sense of what? You say?
Got a sense of humor.
A sense of humor, all right, okay.
Laughing and so forth.
All right, okay.
The joy.
What else do you like about it? It's a strange poem for me. I don't think I've ever talked with any group about this poem. I just kind of put it in because I thought I'd like to hear what you had to say about it.
I've never thought of that. Flesh of the island, that's a very strong way of saying, flesh of the island, I like that.
Okay, that's a good way to start with the poems. Just what strikes you? What language strikes you? What images strike you? What do you say yes to? What do you say what to?
It seems like a gutsy poem to me, because this person says that I've met God on this island. Mm-hmm. I play a game with God.
Mm-hmm. What else? Even more than having met God and played poker with God. I mean, when's the last time you thought about God as a poker player? But even before, right. Even before she got there, what? Why is it gutsy in the getting there as well as in the being there?
She made the commitment.
She made the commitment. What kind of commitment did she make?
To dock at that island.
All right. Okay.
Well, to keep rowing even though her hands get blistered.
Okay. Isn't that a powerful section of it? It's okay, I say to myself, with blisters that broke and healed and broke and healed, saving themselves over and over. So there's gutsiness in the going as well. She says, I'm mooring my rowboat at the dock of the island called God. But we only see in that blistering how long it's taken her to get there, how committedly she's rowed toward that thing.
Many different docks. Some people didn't dock there.
Yeah.
Different religions.
Mm-hmm. This dock is made in the shape of a fish.
That could be
biblical, the sign of the Christ. Uh-huh. Okay, and there are many boats moored at many different docks. She doesn't. There's a whole poem that you could develop. You know, right out of there. You know, what are these other people? What happens on the other docks when these people get finally there in their rowboats? What kind? Does their God play a game with them when they get there? And she could have developed the whole thing, but she doesn't. She just leaves it there. Because she's telling us more what happens with her.
I see a chain of associations. Many people in various stages of belief or disbelief think of God as maybe a game player, or as equal with fate, and fate is being a kind of game player with our lives, in a sense that we are playing a game, or he's playing a game with us. And some people think we're going to ultimately lose, and that's the big tragic mistake. There is no God that really cares that much about us. We're going to lose all. where she is starting to play this game, and I thought, how is that going to end? He has the five aces. It looks like cheating. And that was my thought. Okay, then this is going to be a morbid poem. It's going to end out that something terrible is going to happen to her. She's going to be betrayed in all her efforts to seek God. But then he's laughing at it, that it's okay. She has a wonderful hand. And she did things right, and she should win. And that's great, but he can overcome even her winnings because he's more powerful and even better and even greater. But it's okay, it wasn't a cheating thing. It's just because it's a little different game than she even realized when she was getting there. It was greater than what she realized. And he was greater than she realized, which is an interesting twist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she's what she's doing here in a way is transforming. An image, you know, God is the games player. God is God who is going to win in the end. God who's playing by different rules than we are, just to keep his edge up. But what she does is take that image, which we were afraid might lead to some tragic and morbid ending in the poem, and transform that image, and show us something else happening, you know, in there.
My crazy technical mind asks a question.
Who wants to know what a royal straight flush is?
How do you have one hand with five aces and one hand with a royal straight flush? I think the royal straight flush has an ace also.
Does it have? Oh, come on, all you
players.
What is a royal straight flush?
Ace high.
It's an ace high straight. Okay. Well, a wild card had been announced.
There are four aces plus.
Okay, so we've got.
It's an impossibility.
Ace, king, queen, jack, ten. Okay, that's the royal straight flush. That is the best poker hand possible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, five aces would beat it.
Four aces doesn't beat the royal straight flush.
No.
Okay, so then, and then old God is sitting over here with five aces. So that means there had to be some wild card announced.
Up the sleeve.
Might be two jokers that were wild.
Or else maybe she's not playing with a full deck.
All right, as always here, we're right to...
She grins at her royal flush because she realized she caught job God cheating.
Well, we're right to question these things on poetic grounds, but I might also say that the poet's giving us a metaphor for what's happening in this game, okay? The poet's giving us a metaphor for, what's happening in this game. I know I said that before, it's all right. If you show up and your hand is the best that you can possibly have in human terms, and then God tops you with something else, then he's showing us something that I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Perfection is not human.
Perfection is not human, okay? Say some more about that.
Well, we always are working toward perfectibility, and if you're a perfectionist, like I sometimes tend to be, it's always, you know, well, do it right, do it better, do it more. And I think God is showing us here that that's folly, that perfection only exists in the divine realm.
Even the most perfect possible human hand, okay, is not as good as God's way of playing this game. We can strive as much as we want for perfection, but God, who is the source of all perfection, you know, gets it there. Yeah.
That what you're talking about is sometimes what we call sin when we think that we've accomplished the best.
Isn't that, yeah.
Or that we are perfect or great. Uh-huh. And that therefore God is frowning on us for thinking we're perfect. And instead, here God is laughing.
God laughs. And I was waiting for somebody to say that, because I think that that's really the key to this whole poem. Before we get to the laughing, what happens to the lady? She's found God. She's mooring her boat after having struggled through many, many overwhelming seas and suffered, okay, with the blisters, etc. She's got there, and God says, what are the first words God says to her when she gets to heaven? On with it. I don't know whether I'm expecting those words when I get to heaven. He says, and we squat on the rocks by the sea and play. A little bit of wonder here. Can it be true? Is this what happens when you get to heaven? A game of poker. He calls me. I win because I hold a royal straight flush. Now look at the lady up to that point. She's done everything that's possible to be worthy of coming to God. Okay? Everything that's humanly possible. And as Becky points out to us, it's possible that there might be a little bit of pride going on in this lady. You know, here I've done everything I'm supposed to do, God. Now what you're supposed to do is what I invent that you are supposed to do. Okay? Or what I have learned through all my life is what you're supposed to do. And God's already done a little bit of unbalancing because he wants to play poker with her. What does even playing a game imply? What does that imply?
Chance.
Okay, there's a bit of chance there, all right? There's a bit of luck.
Glenn's going to be a loser.
Okay, all right, it's a competition in which somebody wins and somebody loses. So this might be the final game, the final thing that you have to go through to find out whether you are going to be saved or not. But how does God turn those things over again? Is there a loser in this game? No, there is not. Is there any chance in this game? Not really, because who's making the rules?
God.
God's making the rules.
He hasn't told you all the rules.
He hasn't told you all the rules. And even if you lose, you win in this game. Okay, so there's a lot of unsettling, a lot of turning over on its head going on in this game. And what is the lesson? What does the lady learn about God, the poker player, about God, the island, about... What's the essential thing that she learns?
Love.
Love? What is it that teaches her that love?
It's sort of an accepting, in a sense.
An acceptingness, maybe? It has to be the laughter. Let's read the last part of it again. I win because I hold a royal straight flush. He wins because he holds five aces. A wild card had been announced, but I had not heard it, being in such a state of awe when he took out the cards and dealt. As he plunks down, I love it, as God plunks down his face. It's a word that you use as children, don't you, when you play cards. Plunk that card down. And I sit grinning at my royal flush. All right, now, this is a point of real decision in the poem. You don't quite know what's going to happen at this point. As he plunks down his five aces and I sit grinning at my royal flush. Now, in our understanding of games, somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose. But what happens? He starts to laugh. The laughter rolling like a hoop out of his mouth and into mine. Okay. I laugh with the laughter of God. Okay. And such laughter. God's got the hugest kick out of this whole thing, and he doubles right over me. Okay, now look at that image. Look at what God's doing. Okay, the poet says that he's doubling over her. With the expression, I'm doubled over with laughter, right? What else is that? What else do you see in that image?
Pure joy.
All right, there's an exuberance, an absolute exuberance, that he doubles right over me.
Everything laughs.
Okay, I'm just looking at the physical thing. Look at all the circles going on here. The hoop out of his mouth. He doubles right over me. I see a great sense of protection as well in here. I mean, whatever else might be happening out there on the other islands, God's laughter has caused him to double over me, to protect me in
almost
some way.
Like doubling over, throwing his arms around her.
Yeah, uh-huh. I think there's a bit of, there's that sense of embrace there as well. There's a sexual metaphor as well going on in this poem. You know, God certainly uses all of these metaphors in communicating with his people. He doubles right over me, laughing a rejoice chorus at our two triumphs. I wrote a poem one time, and the line was, we've done the well-nigh impossible. Both won. You know, and I sensed this. Now, our two triumphs. Then what happens? This is a result of God's protective, caressing, exuberant love, what happens? Then I laugh. And not only that, the fishy dock laughs. The sea laughs, that sea through which I had come in so many ways. The island laughs, and beyond the island, what?
The absurd.
Now, where did the absurd come from in here?
That'd be the whole situation.
Sure, it is rather absurd, this whole situation, that God should make heaven or hell dependent on, or we think he should make heaven or hell dependent on a hand of poker. That's pretty absurd. Does the absurd belong in this poem?
The whole thing is absurd.
But what happens? Even that absurdity. When I say the word to you, or when I say, oh, this is absurd, what are we talking about?
It's crazy.
It's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. It'll never make any sense, no matter how hard I try to think through it. Okay, it's absurd. It is cut off from the normal. Okay, it is meaningless. Okay, and the existentialists who taught us this word wanted to teach us that the condition of human beings was a condition of absurdity, that there was no meaning in the world, that anything we tried to do was by its nature devoid of any kind of meaning, except what we put there ourselves if we got around to doing it. But what happens in this poem? The absurd, the very condition of absurdity, is caught up in God's overwhelming laughter. And it too is transformed with this laughter, this joint and shared laughter of God. And so all of this results in a prayer. And the poet prays, "Dearest dealer." Why you laugh at that? You laughed the first time I read it too. Why is that funny?
Uncommon name for God. Okay. All right. Start a prayer.
Okay. Dearest dealer. All right. Any other reason that you laugh?
Oh, dealer's rough and crooked.
Okay.
I laugh because my daughter deals blackjack in summer. They earn money for school. Okay. I can see you calling her dearest dealer.
I laugh because the way the words sound together. Mm-hmm. And there's the poet works by sound as well as by visual image and by meaning as well. Dearest dealer, this contradiction in terms, I with my royal straight flush love you so for your wild card. And what is that wild card? No, what's that wild card? Oh, maybe she's doing some redefining in here. I love you so for your wild card. And she is. She's telling us in the next two lines that untamable, eternal, gut-driven, ha-ha, in lucky, lucky love. Okay, so what's his wild card? His laughter and his loving. Okay, but look at the way she defines for us that laughter. It's untamable. Okay, what does untamable imply for us? Right?
You can't contain it.
Right. Okay. It's out. It's not under anybody's control.
It has its own rules.
Anything else that untamable implies for us here? Okay. It's eternal. It always was. It always will be. It always remains the same. Those words come back to me from my Catholic girlhood, come straight out of the Baltimore Catechism. I don't know what the Lutherans believe about eternal, but that's what I understand eternal to be. It always was. So how many times has God played this game on his dock before? It always will be. And maybe it's in store for us as well. And it always remains the same. It's a gut-driven. That's a curious word in there. I mean, I see untamable and eternal as coming from the situation that the poet's created here. But where does this word come from? God has a gut-driven ha-ha.
From the very center of your being.
All right. Okay, it's not from your head. This is not, I've tricked you with my brain. Okay, it comes out of the middle of you.
When you laugh real hard.
And you laugh real hard, okay? Okay? Good, you feel it in your middle, your solar plexus, wherever that might be. Any other associations with
it's not as contrived with laughter or anything like that. It's a free, open, without any reservations.
And it's driven by your very gut. Not a pretty word, not a poetic word, is it, gut? I mean, we use it in a lot of different ways. It is hard. Mm-hmm. It's earthy. Good. Mm-hmm. It's earthy. And it associates God almost with ourselves as earthy, common people. It's our earthiness, our inmost being, our center of feeling, perhaps, that's driving this ha-ha and lucky love. Well, you liked it, I could tell. You like it now? I mean, now that we've finished talking about it? I do too, I understand it a whole lot more as well. Anybody want to make any final comments on this one?
Lucky love.
Lucky
love needs to be commented on. You know, whether she's looking at it as she's lucky to have the love, or good luck love kind of thing, I don't know. But lucky love, I thought that kind of caught me as far as it.
Caught her too, because it's the last word in her poem. You know, poets always save their best crack at you for last. You know, they figure if you didn't get it up to this time, here, I'm giving it to you once more. So, lucky love is the name of the thing.
You don't take yourself seriously, I think, because God is laughing and he's going to, I mean, God says, well, I've got the upper hand anyway and it's going to turn out right. Uh-huh. So don't take yourself seriously.
Okay. Right.
You have to remember that.
You have to remember that, okay? But you do have to take yourself seriously, too, because it's entirely possible that this lady wouldn't have gotten there to the island at all if she hadn't taken her rowing quite seriously. So yes and no at the same time. To recognize that there's absolutely nothing that we've done to deserve God's love, that's a good Lutheran notion, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we are entirely lucky. In receiving it.
There's a lot of hang in there, boy, in that one. You know, keep going, persistence.
It also sort of implies, you know, at the end of the whole thing, that she could have drifted and got there just as well.
I guess that depends on how you see God here. Does the word magnetic come in this poem? Is there a magnet in this poem?
No.
Okay, it must be in another one I was thinking about. Okay, we could do a couple. How much time do we have?
We have a quarter to.
Quarter to. So 10:45 to 11:45. We really are about finished. Well, there were two more that I'd wanted to look at, and if you like Ann Sexton, please keep this, and you read some of her other things. Sexton,
what's her first?
Sexton, S-E-X-T-O-N, Ann Sexton. After the mood I think we're in with the Sexton thing, I don't really think I want to look at Psalm 90, New Style, because it's a much darker poem, and it's kind of, if Ann Sexton comes to God by way of the absurd, Sebastian Moore says that contemporary man must come to God by the way of darkness, and by the way of the negative, and by the way of not understanding at all. You can take a look at that one if you like, but I think I'd rather take a look at the last one if anybody wants to stay. Anybody who has to go is welcome to go. But the last one in Monica Hellwig's A Cycle of Holocaust Songs, because it does bring us really to a contemporary event which might show us something. This is a new poem for me also. I just found this about a couple of weeks ago. What she's done in this cycle of Holocaust songs is take ancestors of hers in faith, the merits of the fathers is the first section. The second, unless you have stood at Sinai, talks about Moses and Moses' daring and going up to the mountain. The third one, David, the duties of the heart, speaks of David's sensual passion and his pleasure in God as well. Job's question, that's a very strong one, Job's question. It's almost the seeing of the whole world be shattered, be consumed by darkness. A lamentation of Jeremiah shows how God comes in unexpected ways. And then finally, the sixth one is survivor. Shall these bones live? So all of the early examples of her fathers in faith have brought the survivor to this final point. We really should stop. I really shouldn't make you go ahead. Okay, all right, okay. Survivor. The question is, shall these bones live? I think that's an Ezekiel phrase, isn't it? In Ezekiel, who sees the bones and listens to God's word under him. Here's a different Holocaust that she's talking about. Alas, too late I came to my favorite haunt under the juniper tree. Another, a stranger, was there ahead of me. And how should he dare to offer me consolation when I wanted despair? In the bitter atomic glare under the juniper tree, Lord, make an end of me. I am a living curse. My fathers were no worse, my sons will be no better, sheltered from heaven's favor by the mushroom of fear in the sky. Lord, let me die. For how can I walk with divine intoxication when the 40 days' bread is sullen with irradiation and my heart is filled with disgust? Shame, horror, and dust are on Horeb, the holy mountain, and in the desert air, quiet despair. And yet, the troubled prayer of the last longing in the heart to walk the weary wilderness beyond the setting sun, to climb the death rocks of distrust, and once more thrust with all the aching anger of the man I was.